KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit, and we'll be back in just a few minutes.
So where, oh where, do the revolutionaries hide? Have they all decided not to come outside? Give me some more time to know.
Right, it is. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, Mid-Missouri source for in-depth news, diverse talk, and a bunch of good music. And it's a pleasure to be with you here tonight. And as always, Monday night, Radio Orbit, 11 p.m. until 2 a.m. in the morning. And we follow Debbie Johnson, Miss Debbie Johnson, doing wonderful stuff always on Free Range Radio Theater. That's an hour before this program, 10 p.m., right here, KOPN. Before that, Kelvin and Jason doing it up. Jazz plus blues equals Morel Mania. Tech Radio, as always, before that. Interesting stuff, keeping us up on the outrageous world of high technology and gadgetry. Jeff Wheeler starts things off every Monday from 3 to 5 p.m. with Uncommon Light. Great music, great radio. Keep it here, 89.5 FM, KOPN. All right, your imagination station. And it's a pleasure to be with you here and a part of it all, okay? All right, thanks to everyone who listened and participated in the program last week. Big thank you to Bruce Raphael, doing remarkable work in China and around the world, for sure, for many years. Links to his recent research on my site, of course, in the program archives. But yeah, thank you, Bruce Raphael. Wonderful stuff. And if you want to see stuff that Bruce is doing and related work that Kent sort of connects, you can go over to his site at cyberspaceorbit.com, and you'll find Bruce's work, but a whole bunch of other stuff that's sort of tangential and, well, relevant and relative, I guess. Okay? All right, anyway, last week we had it, Bruce Raphael. We also had some interesting music, traditional Chinese music, actually, but if you missed the program, it's all on the web, www.mikehagan.com. In the program archives, just go check it out for yourself, all right? If you like it, share it with somebody else. Okay, tonight, Richard Allen Miller, amazing guy. A little bit more about him in a while, but he's a remarkable fellow. And if you like, you can hop on the web, actually, and go over to my site, go to Orbit, go to MikeHagan.com, and you can read a little bit about Richard and click on through to his site. And if you do that, you can also check out tonight's musical guest there as well. And that's a band called Marcy Playground. And there's info about the band there on the website, okay? Speaking of Marcy Playground, I think we'll play another song here. I need to get things together. And quite frankly, it hasn't been the most easy few weeks. It's been sort of difficult few weeks for me, this transition between spring and summer. Summer actually begins tonight, tomorrow, the 1st of May. We'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes, maybe after the song, but it's sort of a misunderstanding, you know, that summer starts in June. It doesn't. It starts May 1st. And anyway, all right, Spoon Fed, the name of the song. The band is called Marcy Playground. And it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. I'll be back in just a few minutes, all right?
Yeah.
All right, that's a song called Spoon Fed, Marcy Playground. It's Mike Listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. Been thinking a lot tonight about friends and family and just people in general, about what they do and, you know, their lives. I was at my cousin's yesterday in St. Louis, you know, working guy, nice family. And, I don't know. You know, so many people just, are sort of heroes, actually, whether they know it or not. You know, so many people are heroes that go out and maybe do a job that they don't really love, or, maybe got roped into or something, who knows, you know, but, it's a difficult situation for a lot of people out there, and there's not a lot of easy answers. Certainly I know that. And, you know, anyway, for people that are just going out and living their life and doing the best they can in the midst of situations that might not be, you know, the most pleasant, well, you know, here's to you. You're not alone. There are lots of people that do it. Doesn't mean it's good, but at least there's some camaraderie there. And unfortunately, we don't talk enough about it. You know, I'm a person who's lucky, super lucky. You know, I have a life that most people would, you know, probably do a lot of things for. I have a wonderful wife who loves me and, you know, puts up with me in the middle of who knows what, all the things that I'm into and about and all my strange ways and my times and, you know, nice children and healthy. But, you know, I do the same thing. I do the job thing every Monday through Friday. And, you know, there are other things that I'd rather be doing, frankly. You know, I'd like to be with my children more. I'd like to be able to spend more time with my friends. I'd like to be able to do more radio. You know, I'd like to do more things that are fun. And I know lots of other people are like that, too. I want to have more fun and spend time with people that mean things to us, and I don't know, it's just unfortunate that so many people are at such a loss for time because of monetary constraints and economic responsibilities and all this sort of thing, that it becomes difficult to actually live, you know, and do the things that you love, and spend time with the people that you love. The difficulty that we're facing now as a planetary society, as a cultural group, you know, all these things can be tied back to the individual. Culture is nothing more and nothing less than a reflection of the individuals that make it up. And, you know, unfortunately, right now we have a culture that's made up of a lot of individuals that have very little excess time, very little excess money that's required in this particular culture in order to, you know, get a breather. You know, it's a difficult time for lots and lots of people. So I recognize it, and I wish you all the best, and I hope everyone's doing the best they can in the middle of it. And take heart in your friends and your family and the people that love you. And, you know, even if you do have to do things that you don't like, you know, you got a job maybe that's not what you'd like to be doing, whatever. Maybe you're in school and you don't dig it, you know, and your parents force you to do something that you don't like, you know. The song I just played, Spoon Fed, you know, wonderful song by Marcy Playground, but, you know, a depressing song, but the truth of the matter. You know, we have so many people, men, women, children, who are locked up in rooms, whether they do it themselves or other people do it, and, you know, are abused and treated very badly. And in this country and in many, many other countries around the world, it's just the way of the monkey right now. And to think that anybody's really different right now, that's naive and, you know, and infantile. And all of these cultures, whether they're American, you know, pseudo-democracies or Chinese Marxists or whatever, you know, some theological, theocratic creep show, you know, by a bunch of men wearing dresses, you know, that the Vatican and these types of people push. They're all just masks. Joseph Campbell called them the masks of eternity, the masks of God. But the truth of the matter is that what they're trying to mask is monkeys. They're trying to mask our monkeyness and make us think something differently about what we are. That allows us to commit tremendous, tremendous sacrilege, though, when we do those things. Because they allow us excuses as individuals and as a race, as a species. You know, the result of all of these cultures is the news of the day. There's no one better than any others. They're all very troublesome. You know, as our friend Terence used to say, culture is not your friend. Any culture. You know, culture is basically there to keep you roped in and quiet and complacent. It's a neatly packaged system of rules and prescribed behaviors. And if you, you know, pick those up and do those things in that particular culture, you're supposed to be left alone. But it's not doing anybody any good. The people who decide not to go along with the prescription, what they get is alienation. They get alienation. And it's a difficult thing, all of these things, especially when you have children, right? Because you have to decide. You know, are you going to raise morons that capitulate to assholes, you know, and that buy into propaganda and the massive pottage that we've been sold for many, many years, but they get along, you know? Or do you raise, you know, children who buck the system and who, you know, ask questions, learn their own truths, but the price for that is alienation? You know, do you want to do that to your kids? So it's a difficult thing, especially if you're aware of it. The whole ignorance is bliss thing is sort of true, I guess. But when you're aware of all this stuff, you sort of have to balance and try to find a way through it. And it's a jungle and a minefield, you know, with traps around every corner, especially for children. It's hard enough as an adult. Most adults are acting like children. But imagine actually being one. My gosh, it's a difficult thing. Because you're taught, for the most part, you know, be a good person. Tell the truth. You know, be honest. These sorts of things. Yet we raise our children in a culture that is filled with liars and deceivers and, you know, propaganda artists and, you know, medicine show people that, you know, will dazzle you with BS, but that's about it. And those are the things that won't actually get you in physical danger. You know, then there are other, you know, being a child is actually dangerous physically in many cases. You know, you have parents or other people that are involved with the children that are abusive. Maybe because they've been abused, you know, and I'm sorry for anybody out there who's been hurt or been harmed, you know, no matter how old you are. I'm sorry about that. It's horrible. And, you know, I hope that you can heal. And children are a great way to heal. Rather than, you know, continuing the same algorithms that were meted out by, you know, your satanic parents or whatever. You know, you don't have to do that. You can actually have sort of a second chance through your children. And, you know, take the good things that your parents may have shown you, as little or as much as that may be, and toss out the bad. You know, toss out the nasty stuff. Get through it. And don't repeat it. with your own children. And, you know, love them and hold them close and teach them how to learn. You know, teach them how to learn. Not how to recite things out of a book, but how to learn. Reciting things out of books is not helping anybody. When the books are all written by people who have, you know, very, very ill intent. And we're teaching our children a whole bunch of stuff that's, frankly, I mean, as far from true as, you know, as you can imagine, really. So, you know, for parents and children alike, it's difficult for adults and children alike. But the adults have to shoulder the responsibility. In other words, to say, you know, the children need to do something. They really need to, you know, these young people need to rise up and do something about what's going on right now. No, they're children. They're trying to figure out what the hell is going on. The people that need to fix things are us, you know. The people who are in the middle of their lives and who have had enough experience to realize a con game when they see one, but also still have enough energy where they can actually do something about it, you know, instead of go stick your head in the sand and collect your paycheck, which is what so many people do, you know, and go watch the Cardinals game or whatever, you know. But this is childish behavior. It's immature, it's infantile, and it is very dangerous at this point in the game. No pun intended. It's okay to recreate. You know, it's okay to take a break and watch a ball game or to play the ball game, whatever. You know, I prefer actually doing rather than watching. But the point of the matter is there are many, many, many things that are happening around us that require serious thought, serious intelligence, serious problem solving. And, you know, the games are fine, but they should not be the primary priority in the life, perhaps. Certainly the primary and number one priority of everyone should be our children. All of our children. You know, all of our children. It's not just, you know, people are so stuck on their own children and ruining their lives. You know, they don't even think about the other children that are out there who are in the middle of a situation that is very, very desperate and would bring shame upon anyone who acts as if their own children are the only thing that matters. It's not like that. You know, our children matter, all of them. I wonder what it was like, you know, this whole idea of male paternalism is such a big deal, you know, it's such a big deal. And, you know, there was a time when our monkey ancestors were doing things differently. And, you know, the culture was different. Society was different. Human monkeys have been around in this particular form with the same brain, the same, you know, everything. The ability to make poetry and art and all this stuff for 100,000 years, 150,000 years. And we have skeletons to prove it. Very little has changed since then. Language, which popped on the scene, what, you know, 35, 50,000 years ago, people debated back and forth, but not, you know, even the straight evolutionary biologists say no more than 50,000 years, probably. Well, what was going on the other 100,000 years when we were the same? Language is behavior. It's a behavioral thing. It's not a physiological difference. The ability to create spoken language was a behavioral thing. You know, nothing physiological changed. So for 100,000 years, we just didn't say anything. Grunts and points and, you know, this and that. But 50,000 years ago, some monkey hacked into the whole business and decided, hey, I can take a random utterance and give it a signification. And as long as other people agree upon the signification, the signal, the sign, then, you know, everyone will know what we're talking about. And, you know, it was just a behavioral thing. Somebody got a yin, you know, felt the touch. And there was no turning back after that. And language, you know, you could argue whether it's been a good thing or a bad thing. My gosh, it's caused us a whole lot of trouble because people lie. People use language irresponsibly. You know, they misrepresent words on purpose or, you know, because of naivete, foolishness. But we've been very, very naive in the importance of language and our perception of the world and the reality that we see and that we actually, you know, are a part of. And of course the social engineers and, you know, the Joseph Goebbels and all these people of the world, you know, the Donald Rumsfelds and all the speech writers of these clowns in Washington that call themselves people when they're not, they're hardly human because their hearts are hard and they talk, but they don't do anything to help our children. And it's simple. You know, the way to judge a culture, the way to judge a society, is not on the makeup and all the rhetoric that's spinning around back and forth and all this stuff. It's simple. How do they take care of their children? And in our case, and I'm not just picking on America here, you know, I'm picking on the whole ball of wax, right? This whole marble. You know, we have really, really gone astray with regard to our kids. You know, Mercedes-Benzes and, you know, fancy diplomas and, you know, the house on the lake. All that stuff has somehow, you know, become more valuable and more heavily weighted than our children. And the effects of it just plain to see, the news of the day. And, you know, there are days when I'm really hopeful, and then there are days when I'm not. And I guess that's probably the way everybody is, and the way the world works, and evolution, and all that sort of thing. But it's just hard when you're in the middle of it, you know, the day to day. You sort of wish evolution would sort of get on with it. But, you know, it's just not the way. Can't force things. You just got to do the best you can with what you got, in the middle of what you got, and you know, keep pushing and keep learning, and try to do your best to help those around you and yourself, I guess. You know, so many people are so broken and hurt and confused themselves that you know, even when they try to help other people, they can be dangerous because, you know, they don't have clarity. And, you know, myself included in this whole business, you know. I'm nothing special. Gosh, I mean, I'm trying to figure it all out too, as much as everybody else is. And it's so sad that we have to do it, you know, in the middle of, you know, a culture that literally rewards deception and rewards discompassion and rewards, you know, brutality and heartlessness. I mean, if you look at the leaders, it doesn't matter if you look at the leaders of your city or your country or your corporation or your institutionalized religion or your healthcare system, you know, or your education system. All of these institutions that are so somehow supposed to be so special and so sacred, well, they're filled with people that are just vermin, you know, heartless people that have no interest in helping children, frankly. You know, they're interested primarily in helping themselves. And it's not that hard to discover these things. So, you know, for the people that are, that realize it, gosh, it's difficult because you try to find a, you know, an alternative, and you pretty much have to do your own thing. Find like-minded people, and you know, hopefully come up with something. Or if you're lucky enough to have, you know, someone in your area that's already hip to this stuff, and you know, trying to come up with solutions in the middle of a society and a culture that has no interest in solutions. Anyway. I'm sorry if I'm being a downer, but I'm actually just trying to be honest and tell people out there that, you know, if you're feeling difficulty and, you know, frustrated with deceit and dishonor and all the things that are now somehow, you know, mainstays of the culture, well, you know, just try to do the best in the middle of it and teach your children, you know, that it's not the way. And the way to teach your children is by doing it yourself, you know. It's not by telling them. Kids don't give a damn what you tell them. They are looking for models. All of us who are parents know our children just do exactly what we do. They want to do everything that we do. They just want to do what we do. And, you know, if you do good things and you have your priorities, you know, in a decent situation, it'll be good for your kids. It'll be good for other kids because, you know, that stuff spreads around. And, you know, good ideas and good memes and good intention and good tradition and all these things, you know, they can spread too. You know, they're infectious too, just like, you know, the memes of consumer capitalism, you know, which wants to, you know, spread the marketplace to every corner on the globe and won't rest until everybody's got a 72-inch plasma screen TV and is hooked into it like an IV, getting spoon-fed, you see, whatever the culture decides to feed. But see, that's what's happening. I mean, you're getting the agenda of Wall Street, Madison Avenue, you know, fascist interests in, you know, the global war industry, the arms industry, the military, industrial, congressional, collegiate system. The military industrial complex includes universities, it includes governments, and it includes all of our Congress people. You know, these things need to be included when people talk about the military industrial complex. Include the people who are actually, you know, doing it. Congress. These people could stop all this stuff in a moment if they wanted to. They talk about it so, what are we supposed to do? How do we do? You just do it. They could, that's the Congress. You can pass anything you want. You can repeal anything you want. You can do it all in 5 minutes. But they act like they have no power. And so, you know, whether they're just inept or whether they're actually, you know, being driven by somebody else's agenda, you know, whatever. That's just the, you know, that's sort of a side note. The point is they're not doing it, they're not doing anybody any favors. And they're certainly not helping our children. Not in this country and not anywhere else. And that's what the conversation should be about. You know, it's frustrating to see them. You know, you got the election coming up in 2008. Everybody's already, you know, beaten off about that. And, you know, the pundits on the television, which I've got to watch very little of, but I have to peek once in a while, you know, just to see what, you know, what the latest rap is. But, of course, it's the same as the old rap for the most part. It's who's got the most money. I mean, they basically self-congratulate people about who's raising the most money. And as if this is some indication of ability or goodness or something like that. I mean, if you haven't noticed, you know, the people with the most money are usually the biggest jerks. So, anyway, all this stuff is, you know, generalized. And I recognize that, you know, there are many good people in the middle of all this stuff, too, doing the best they can. And there are good people with money, too. And if you're a good person with money, give some to this radio station, all right? And other places that are trying to, you know, stop the flood of propaganda, or at least counter it a little bit, you know. Anyway, I had to get my guest on the phone here. His name is Richard Allen Miller. I'm sorry the program has been a little bit, you know, off the track of what it typically is, but hey, that's the way it goes. All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, and this song, I was going to do Space Weather, so we'll try to do a little Space Weather after this. It's called Hotter Than the Sun. Back in a minute. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit. Marcy Playground, that's called Hotter Than the Sun. It's Mike, you listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN, Columbia. All the stuff we're hearing tonight is from a CD that is called MP3. And good stuff from Marcy Playground. You can find information about them on the web at www.marcyplayground.net. And you can link over there from my site, of course, okay, over in the music archives. And something on the front page for them, of course, right now, okay? A little bit more from Marcy Playground as we move through the program tonight. And, well, a little bit more about the program. I need to shift gears here and tell you what's happening. Richard Allen Miller, I mentioned him at the beginning of the hour, but I hope you've all had a chance to get on the web and go sniff around over at Richard's website. You can link over there from my site as well. Northwest Botanicals is the name of his site, and like I said, you can link right over there from MikeHagan.com, all right? Anyway, Richard will be with us in about 10 minutes. Let me say hello to everybody listening on KOPN over the traditional airwaves or over the web. Of course, KOPN is a 40,000-watt FM station, sending it out over the air to mid-Missouri and anywhere else that'll reach us there on the frequency-modulated dial. And we're doing the web thing, too, though, and I appreciate the fact that people can listen locally or anywhere else in the world if they, in the world, I guess, if they have the gumption. All right? Okay. Cosmic Waves Radio. I need to say thank you to them as well. They are sort of a sister stream that happens on Monday night as well here. And thank you to all the good people over there at Cosmic Waves Radio. Thank you to my friend Larry, the web wizard. He's back in Hawaii and at long last back with us, actually working on a new updated design for the website, and awesome as ever. So thanks, Larry. And thank you also to all the people out there sending art, music, poetry, new stuff all the time. And I'm sorry if I don't do a great job of keeping on top of it, but I do my best and just send it, all right? And we'll get through it and find a place for it on the site, share it with other people, okay? Check it out, by the way. Let me know what you think. Go over to the website, MikeHagan, HAGAN.com. You'll have access to everything we're doing. No, no funny business. And, just go see what you want, download what you want, and share what you like with other people, okay? The forum is wonderful. It's a bulletin board / forum that's always busy and interesting topics being discussed all the time. Again, more than I can keep up with. And a live chat room up and active during the program every week and any other time that people decide that they want to use it. Okay? I encourage my guests as well as listeners to join us in the chat and the forum. And simply do, just go to the website and just click on the appropriate button. All right? Okay, my email address, orbitradio@aol.com. Send email to me. I appreciate it, whether it's good, bad, or ugly. You know, feedback is wonderful, and it's what we all need. And my guests and the musicians that are featured on the program appreciate your communications as well. So correspond with us, all right? And share your ideas and your thoughts, and, we'll try to do the same with you. All right, the phone number here at the station, 573-443-8255. That's if we decide to take calls later, I'll let you know if we do, but we'll see, all right? Anyway, what do we got? We got a few minutes left here. I'll do a quick bit here on who's coming up on the program in the next few weeks. Do a real short abbreviated space weather and play another piece of music. We'll come back with Richard Allen Miller at the top of the hour, okay? All right, that's what's happening tonight, Richard Allen Miller. And again, on the web, you can check out Richard's work at northwestbotanicals.org. .org or .com, I'm not sure exactly. Just go to my site and double check it. I should actually have it up here in my I should actually have it up on my screen in front of me anyway, and I will in a second. But the best way until I get my act together is just go over to my site and link over from there. But it's Northwest Botanicals. I want to say .org, and I'm sure Richard will clear that up for us when we have him on the air in just a few minutes here. Okay, but anyway, that's tonight. Next week, we have Mary J. Getten, and Mary's a real cool lady, and she talks about intelligence in nature, essentially, animals and communication with them. We'll be talking a lot about the cetacea, about dolphins and orcas and this sort of thing, but the metaphor sort of can be extended throughout the natural world, and I talk about it all the time, you know, the idea that, you know, nature is intelligent, and it's not abstract. You know, there are creatures and plants and, you know, things out there that are intelligent and capable of communication. But like all things, and like all relationships, you know, it takes effort, time, work, intention, you know, love, all that stuff. So anyway, we'll talk with Mary J. Getten about that next week on the 7th of May. Gary David on the 14th of May. He's written a book called Orion and the Hopi. It's very interesting. So we'll talk with Gary David about the relationships above and below. Paul Laffoley, wonderful, amazing, you know, a polymath and ridiculously talented artist and architect, Paul Laffoley, back on the 21st of May. And, well, lots of other stuff coming up in the next few months. Richard Tarnas, Patrick Flanagan, Neil Adams, and John Major Jenkins again, of course, sometime soon. So Anyway, we'll do it up and try to do the best we can. Okay, tonight, sometime, I'll give away a copy of a book called The Modern Alchemist. It's written by Richard Allen Miller, our guest who will be on with us in just a few minutes here. But it's a wonderful book, and I have an extra copy of it. So sometime tonight, we'll take a break, I don't know, between now and 2 a.m., and hopefully I remember to give it away. Okay? And what else? Announcements. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, born May 1st, 1881. Mother Jones, born May 1st, 1830. We could talk a lot about these people, but I don't have time. But both wonderful people in their own rights and people who should be remembered. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, and he was a Jesuit, for God's sake. So you can't get down on me about, getting down on the Vatican, all right? I just get down on people who deserve to be gotten down on. And Chardin was a wonderful guy with great thoughts and good ideas and, trying to move forward the brother and sisterhood of humanity. And so was Mother Jones, born on the same day, May 1st, 1830. And Chardin, 1881, actually. All right, one more thing. KOPN, a big show this Friday, the 4th of May. Rutherford, Big Medicine, Caulfield and the Magic, In Thicket, Bachman, and a band called the Hooten Howlers, I think. I don't have their name written down. But anyway, six bands. Going to start at 6 p.m. with a really cool happy hour show with Ruth and Jeff and the band Rutherford. And I'm really looking forward to it, and I hope a lot of people come down to support the local musicians. I mean, killer music. These guys are all great. And also support KOPN. It's only going to cost $5, and it'll go until, 1 in the morning, and you'll get to hang out with a bunch of cool people and listen to great music and support KOPN. So I sure encourage everyone who's out there listening to come on down to the Blue Fugue. It's 120 South 9th Street. On Friday the 4th, and we'll have a great time, okay? All right, space weather. Big giant sunspot, 953 it's designated. I mean, just looking to unload, all right? So we'll see what happens. Keep your eyes on the sun, though. What else is happening up there? I had a whole bunch of things to talk about, but we're just going to sidestep that. Go over to spaceweather.com if you're interested. Go to cyberspaceorbit.com, Kent's site, if you're interested, and you can follow up on your own, okay? In the news, I had a few things I wanted to talk about. There's a huge prehistoric lost country that they found now hidden below the North Sea. It's being investigated. Amazing story by the BBC came out today. Science and spirituality, Heisenberg, Werner Heisenberg's mystical experience. You know, all these scientists had some sort of a mystical experience that set them off. Angels and dreams and who knows what. But so much of science is based in the mystic. It's hilarious. But you don't find the guys, beaten on their benches talking much about, Rene Descartes and his mystical dream experiences that set him off on the whole scientific adventure. At any rate, rocket fuel in the water now, the whole environment, just take a sample, the air, the earth, the water. We got rocket fuel, perchlorate, sugar perchlorate, whatever the hell it is, in the water now. They're finding it everywhere. I read a story the other day about, infants. If you take a blood test of a child, pretty much anywhere on the planet, you find Teflon and these products that have been used for nonstick cookware. They're in everybody. And they're out here passing laws in my town to tell people they can't have a cigarette. In the meantime, people are breathing poison, drinking poison, growing food from poisonous soils, and letting this business just continue unabated. It's absolute psychopathy is what it is, and it's actually very frightening. But it's what it is right now, so if you recognize it, tell people how silly it is, okay? All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. What else in the news? Who killed the electric car? Of course, the same usual suspects, all right? Humongous fungus, this big, gigantic, prehistoric fungus. They finally identified what it was. And we'll be talking about mushrooms and some other things with our guest, Richard Allen Miller, in just a couple minutes, okay? I got to get on with things here. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. Back in just a minute with Richard Allen Miller. And we'll play a quick one here from Marcy Playground as I get ready, okay? This one's called No One's Boy, appropriate for me tonight, okay? Take care of yourselves. It's Mike. Listen to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few ticks with Richard Allen Miller.
Radio Orbit with Mike Hagan on KOPN 89.5 FM.
All right, everybody, hello. It's Mike Hagan. I'm back at you here. It is Radio Orbit. We're just a couple of ticks after midnight, and we're going to welcome our guest in just a moment here. His name is Richard Allen Miller. He began a career in agriculture probably 35 years ago or so, 1972, with the formation of a company that was called the Beltane Corporation. And I mention that now because, actually, today, May 1st, is Beltane. And we'll have Richard maybe talk a little bit more about that. But he's a man who's been involved in all kinds of things for many, many years, ranging from work for the U.S. government to what he does now with an amazing website and business called northwestbotanicals.org. And it's on the web, by the way, at nwbotanicals.org. So without further delay, we will say hello and welcome to Radio Orbit to Richard Allen Miller. Hi, Rick.
Good morning.
Pleasure to have
you.
Well,
it's not morning yet, but I feel like it.
Well, it is here. It's just two minutes after midnight, so you got away with it.
Cool.
Anyway, the Beltane Corporation, right? It's Beltane.
Yeah,
so happy,
Beltane.
Happy summer day, I guess.
Well, it's the maypole, you know, that big pole they put in the center of the ground, and then all the festal virgins dance around it.
And what's that all about?
Beltane and Samhain were pagan ceremonial periods of the earth, before, you know, we had our Christian forms. Samhain was All Hallows Eve. That was the end of harvest. Big bonfires were built, and you leaped over in relief that everything was put away for the winter.
Right, you actually did it, yeah.
Yeah, and then and that was the end of farming that year. Beltane was when you planted your first seeds. They'll note today that's when usually your irrigation goes on, you know, to start irrigating crops. Usually we try to get our crops in the field on the 1st of May, and if we're, you know, annuals and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
It's the beginning of new ventures. It's the beginning of things, and that's what Beltane means, is the beginning of new ventures.
All right. You know, it's interesting because a lot of people think that summer begins on the solstice, on June 21st. Of course, that's it's these cross-quarter dates where the beginnings and endings are, I guess.
Yeah, there are, there's a lot of religious infiltration, if you would. But mostly, by June 31st, your crops are already gone through first harvest if you're doing mints or other things like that.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, we'll talk about a bunch of this stuff as we get going here because I'm so interested in things that grow. Before we get there, let's talk a little bit about shamanism. You and I have been talking off the air quite a bit lately in the last couple of weeks about some of this stuff, but I'd like to get your take on shamanism and what you think about it and what good it might be for anybody and what its limitations are and all this stuff.
Shamanism is a interesting level of consciousness. It has to do... John Curtis Gowan is where I'll take my relationship to. He taught at Northridge. He wrote books like The Development of the Psychedelic Individual, which, by the way, has nothing to do with drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Has to do with enlightenment.
Mm, interesting. Yeah, psychedelic. And, I mean, the word itself means to cleanse the mind or clear the mind.
That's correct.
Right.
And he received a Nobel Prize, actually, for his work in anthropology, actually developing an ontology of mystical states. He related one thing to another as automatic writing above or below audio hearing, you know, those kinds of things where you hear voices or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in a book called Trance, Art, and Creativity. I used that book as a textbook for almost 6 years when I taught shamanism at the University of Washington, and then later as first faculty at Evergreen. His work was monumental in putting things together. Now, trance states are called prototaxic mode. That means there's no awareness of what you're doing.
Hmm.
And that would include shamanism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, modes...
Give me an idea of time frame from when
1970.
Okay.
I taught in 1970. I had friends that were Indian that had formed up a medicine lodge up on the Ho River.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I was working Navy intelligence. I was Intel.
O-N-I? Is that what it was? Officer?
No. Which Ho? Oh, Ho. H-O-H.
Yes, but you were working for the Office of Naval Intelligence, or what were you doing?
I was working first with Navy SEALs. I was their spook physicist that did all the ESP studies for SEAL Corporation. And then I moved up to Spook Central under Dr. Carl Schleicher, MRU, Mankind Research Unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
I was the Northwest Regional Director and ran most of the paranormal studies on the West Coast from as far south as China Lake, Argonne National.
All the stuff that supposedly never took place, right?
Yeah, well, they had us. I eventually was working directly out of anesthesiology at the University of Washington.
Uh-huh.
And the guy on this lab over here was a guy named Delgado before he moved to Harvard and had monkeys with chips in their head. And the other guy on the other side of me was Dr. Moore doing ketamine, telepathy, and BZ studies. Myself, I was running the programs and basically had, I did time travel studies. I did, you know, because I had studied. That's another interesting story. But when I didn't find answers in physics, I mean, where does one go then?
Right.
And I was encountering Peter First and I went down to Mexico,
mm-hmm.
and this is a typical thing that I would do. I went down to Mexico, and I actually encountered a brujo, a shaman, that
mm-hmm.
was
mm-hmm.
essentially Don Janeiro. It was Don Juan in Castaneda series. It was a made up kind of a collective of different shamans, but Don Janeiro existed.
Must be a real person, right?
We got a picture of him,
huh.
And it's in the public. You can actually see him flying. leaping from one rock to another in a rare publication called Arts Canada, and the specific issue is Stones, Bones, and Skin, and it was on shamanism, shamanistic art, mostly West Coast Indians doing, because that's what I studied mostly, were Haida and Tlingit and, mm-hmm. and those
and
things.
Colquittal and those.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and, I actually began teaching shamanism at the university in 1971 and was teaching at Evergreen a number of different courses, including shamanism, by 1974. Now,
what would
shaman,
you teach? How do you teach shamanism?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Castaneda had not written all of his books by that period.
Mm-hmm.
There were other rare books out. I have one on peyote music from 1947 that included, which, by the way, the Native American religion is a political thing. It was not really a religion at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was done for sovereignty, you know, so mm-hmm. that they could set up things. We'll talk about that as we get to it. Let me give you a definition of what I used for a shaman.
Yeah, please.
A shaman is a psychically unstable person, which a lot of us are, that receive a call to religious life. And as a result, they go through a period of solitude or retreat where they then emerge with a power, real or assumed, to pass it. States of mental dissociation. They can move their consciousness to another thing, like a bird
mm-hmm.
or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know how to do this, and that's why Gowan classified that as prototaxic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean they can't do paranormal things. There is an excellent movie that is extremely rare called Chak, C-H-A-K. And that movie actually demonstrates a true shaman. They actually got a real shaman
mm-hmm.
that changes weather, and they followed his life
wow.
in terms of what would be involved to try to, you know, and what happened to him and what happens to a lot of shamans. It's an interesting thing. The
you say a real shaman. In other words, there are lots of wannabes.
No. In my definition, I was very careful to say real or assumed. Yeah. The imagination and one's self and introspection is often flawed,
mm-hmm.
and that's why one needs to continually try to receive dialogue between
mm-hmm.
yourself and your higher self so
right.
that you have this balance of credibility with yourself, not just with what's going on in the world.
Right.
There's a fine line. When you're taking strange drugs, or you're doing strange forms of rituals that allow you to go into an altered state, that's what I was interested in. I have studied altered states of consciousness as another form of universes that we can travel in, and I'm now writing books on the subject of this state you can do this, that state you can do that. What these altered states are very useful tools to be able to do things you can't do in conscious states or in what you would call normal reality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Extrasensory perception, by the way, the prototaxic is then followed by parataxic, which is art states. And this is where you work with dreams,
mm-hmm.
mythology, and what we call archetypal participation, where you're dealing with an archetype.
Okay.
And then syntactic modes, the highest states of consciousness, would be where you found magicians rather than sorcerers. That's where you'll use
mm-hmm.
biofeedback, you'll use tantric yoga, sex magic,
mm-hmm.
you'll move into the higher realms of what we call jhana states. And the Buddhists actually said the enlightened states of cosmic consciousness actually had 8 different levels of that, and these were called jhana states in Buddhism. And they're similar and different. And having a universal hit where everything is one, there's levels of that, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Gowan did, was he laid out the form for what you're looking for to see where you are.
Mm-hmm.
There's in the Upanishads, there is a...
The Indian writings.
There's a song called Voice of the Silence, and it's been translated by Blavatsky and Crowley, several others, that give you a mystical state of where you are spiritually. And there are 10 sounds, and when you hear the Shabad, or the sound current, or the voice of the silence, that place, predicated on what you hear in your right ear, this is very important, it's the right ear.
Mm-hmm.
It may be tinnitus, you know, your ears ringing, but if it's not, and there's a protocol to determine whether or not you're just hallucinating, that'll tell you where you are spiritually. Voice of the silence, actually, you know, the bagpipe, the chime, the bell ringing, there's different sounds that mm-hmm. one hears, and that will determine what level of consciousness you're at regarding listening to the sound current. They call it the Shabad, S-H-A-B-D, sound current.
All right.
And that's your voice of the sign, that's your rainbow bridge, that's the serpent at the end of the rainbow mm-hmm. singing, the mm-hmm. lost chord, as they would call it.
All right. Now, so the differences between these things is being the shaman really has, in other words, he or she has really no understanding of how what's happening is happening and really can't control it.
But that's part of the definition of what a shaman is
uh-huh.
as opposed to a magician.
Right, and then these next levels come further along in these different states of consciousness.
Well, in your relationship to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And
okay.
And that's what I taught in 1972. And so, of course, you learn immediately that the Nagual is the unspeakable, as Castaneda would put it. Reality is that which cannot be known. It can only be experienced, and anything that is known would be tonal, or what he called illusion.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we have our own ways of saying that in a more contemporary vocabulary today, but the truth of it is that at any level, consciousness is such a small portion of what's going on inside you that to articulate it often is to define illusionary things, now, things that aren't really real.
Mm. Amazing.
What?
What?
Oh, yeah.
Would you talk a little bit more about some of your experiences then? Because this whole business about felt experience and the unspeakable. Well, I mean, we try to put words on it or whatever. But maybe talk about some of your experiences that you know that you've had.
I was invited to participate with David Four Lions. David Four Lions was the leader of the Ho River Medicine Lodge, and I had grown up with a lot of the Indians. Mostly they were Canadian non-status treaty Indians like Suchwap, Thompson. They're up all on the Fraser up near Salmon Arm up in Canada. And the Ho River is in Washington State. And in 1971, a longboat was taken from the Ho River to the ocean and then sailed up to Nia Bay,
uh-huh.
where the Indians
cool.
went into the water and brought, in traditional fashion, brought the canoe, the longboat,
uh-huh.
To shore without any of the participants touching the water, and that was bringing back the medicine to the Macaw. That was in 1971, and I was there. I experienced it. I was fortunately invited to be part of that, and I had a kind of religious experience because it affected my way of seeing what's going on.
Mm.
And the journey itself, going past Tatoosh Island and the waves, and where all these, that's in Washington State, that's where all the shipwrecks are, is up there by Tatoosh Island. The weather up there.
Yeah, it gets wild up there.
Yeah, and uncontrollable, and there's old ships still. When I was young, I used to hike out to a very rare beach called Shai Shai Beach.
Uh-huh.
And you'd go up to Nia Bay and then into down the other side of Washington, a little Indian village called Soyuz, and then you'd hike in. And it was a six-mile hike in, and there were a couple of cabins that had been built on these beaches, and there were dug in people. Some of them were from the Love family. I know that Freedom Love was up there, and a couple of others from the old Love family. And, we would go in on weekends, and when Strong Eagle was going to die, he was a Sitka medicine man. He asked, he wanted to pass on the medicine, which, by the way, medicine are the songs and dances of the tribe. That's their historical way of remembering medicine. And medicine, I'll give you a better definition of medicine. Medicine is when you come up over a hill and you look down and you see where your incomes are going to come from for the next 3 months. That's medicine. I mean, you know, God given one to you, you know. And but medicine was the songs and dances, and I was fortunate to be included in the three of us that were given the medicine for the Sitka tribe. Sitka's totem is Orca, the killer whale. And I personally believe that Orca is a more evolved entity than man because its cerebral cortex is twice the size of man, and he's firing 60% of it. When I was working with John Lilly, and we went into his labs for the dolphin studies, I was there only 10 days. I was one of Carl Sagan's boys. I was there only 10 days when I recognized the clicks and whistles of a dolphin being a form of Clifford algebra. And that meant their language was like an order of magnitude more. Hebrew, which I speak, I studied with Mercy Eliade. I did all of that. I was one of his students. Is very basic in compared to Clifford algebra, and the dolphin had this kind of language. And so when I looked at the dolphin, I realized they're even lower on the food chain than orca. And so there's a whole host of cetacean that are more evolved, in my belief. Just because they don't have a thumb or fire, which we call cybernetic anthropology, does not mean they do not have an evolved system of relationship.
And it's I'm sorry to
that's fine.
Jump
ahead.
In, but there, I have a friend who you mentioned, John Lilly, of course, who's wonderful and did amazing work for a long, long time, and he had lots of people who. You know, he influenced. There's a guy named Michael Heisen.
I know him, yeah.
You know Mike Heisen?
Yeah, yeah.
No, he's
a
friend of mine. We're from the same hometown, actually.
Wow.
he's doing real good work, you know, with the dolphins, and he lives out there in Hawaii, but he has been on the program before, and we've talked a lot about, you know.
I'd heard that you were going to cover that. I'm interested. I'll probably listen to that one. I was fortunate. I got to go to a rehab center for dolphin in Florida, in Key Largo, called Dolphins Plus. In fact, I got to go there twice. And I'm going to give you an example of their awareness. I got to be in the tank with like five dolphins for more than 4 hours. I got to know them.
Mm-hmm.
They got to know me.
Sure.
This one, Cosmo, one of the things the trainer was doing was having the dolphin come up behind you and you put your hand out and grab a fin. And be dragged along with a fin. I have this on video. It's wonderful.
Cool.
But this dolphin, two dolphins came up, and the one on the left of me was, without that trainer knowing it, knew that my arm wasn't real. I don't have, one of my arms I lost all the bone from the wrist up past the elbow, and so I have a composite, and my elbow is like a wire strap. It's about 4 inches smaller.
But it's a prosthetic.
Well, no, it's I didn't lose my arm. Uh-huh. What I lost was all the bone in it.
Oh,
and
it
was a chainsaw accident. Don't go there.
Very
anyway, anyway, what happened was the dolphin on the left of me, probably from sonar.
Oh, sure. You see,
whatever, knew that my arm wasn't real and towed me differently.
That's
and
amazing.
I looked at the dolphin. The dolphin looked back at me. I have to tell you, I felt like I was in the presence of a real alien, something that was way more aware than I was. And I don't mean a little bit more aware. I mean way out there, which means that Orca
who knows where
may be going places we can't even comprehend, even with evolution. You know, when you have a cerebral cortex that size and you're firing it, What does that mean?
What does it mean? I know it's I'm a scuba diver, and I've been in the water with these creatures too, you know, and I'm with you, man. I've seen things with my own eyes that just make me realize, certainly, and I don't know much about the details, you know, but I can tell you that that animal is absolutely intelligent.
Yeah, they've,
you know?
Through the Navy at one point, I didn't participate in those studies. I was working with Sagan, but at the Navy actually tried to train them to be weapons.
They just wouldn't do it, though. Yeah.
And they worked, but yeah. I have to tell you, why would you do that?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's like, I don't know. You know, that's one of the reasons why I went into farming. Once I realized what I was doing, I did all the microwave studies and ELF weapons.
Mm-hmm.
That was what I did for Navy. And when I realized what I was doing, I became a dirt farmer.
Mm-hmm.
Went into herbs, and I went into the country and became a country boy. Lived in the Okanagans, started farming up there. Today, I have farming and wildcrafting ongoing projects in almost every state and every province in Canada. My
That's
books,
so cool. What do you got going here in Missouri?
Oh, in Missouri, well, you got your snake root, you know, your Kansas and Missouri snake roots. They're different. The Germans grabbed the wrong one. Missouri was whom I studied with Willard McGee. He had, out of Veolia, he had the big, he is the largest now. It's, who studied with him? The two brothers. They have now running American Botanical, and they do a lot of wildcrafting, and they buy a cascara from me. You know, we each region has specifics. Yours was pink root. You have in your state a lot of. I'm drawing blanks. Because
I'm right by the river. I'm right by the Missouri River.
Yeah, that would be Maypop. Which is, they did a lot of Maypop there. Of course, you had your ginsengs, your sangs, and you had, in Missouri, there is now a 1,500-acre forest farm of ginseng where they don't use the lath housing anymore like they did early, but it terraces down a large stream of water,
cool.
1,500 acres, and they grow some really killer ginsengs there.
Really?
And, yeah. That's in Missouri, yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, yeah, I don't even like the words own, but anyway, I have, you know, about 13 acres of land that we live on, and I'm learning about the plants that live there, you know?
Yeah.
And trying to, you know, get more familiar and
You know, Chuck Walters out of Kansas City, Missouri,
mm-hmm.
Before his son moved it to Metairie, Acres USA, was the publisher of some of my books. They talk about, he wrote a book called Weeds and What They Say About the Soil. You know, you can tell more about soil by the way the weeds migrate on the soil than any type of topological map, you know,
right,
that might have soil type.
Scientific analysis, any of this.
Yeah, or running soil samples. Yeah, the weeds will tell you more about what's going on with your A and B horizons than anything. They're very interesting, you know. And
weeds
the
themselves, it's so funny, it's sort of like a derogatory term, but a lot of them are actually very valuable and
well,
beneficial
plants. Well, weed means
plants, right?
A plant out of place because the way it's classified, the county extension agent that puts out the noxious weed list for each state, those are the plants that cattle won't eat. That's the way a weed is defined.
Is that right?
That's right. It's a plant out of place. It's not a bad thing or a good thing. It's a weed when a cow won't eat it. Because you got to realize, historically, that was what they did,
right.
Was range cattle. And if the cattle wouldn't eat it, you know, in Washington State, the two noxious weeds that are at the top of the list are baby's breath, you know, which
mm-hmm.
is used in florals,
sure.
St. John's wort.
Wow, yeah.
And when we did the big harvest of St. John's wort early on, because I'm the discoverer of that one, we had to get a noxious weed permit. And actually, it was the first one out of Washington State. And they didn't understand St. John's wort. So, of course, I'm used as an expert because we knew more about the plant than County Extension does. Interestingly, I'd like to diverge on that for one moment.
Please.
It turns out, I did a study with USDA on St. John's wort, because we knew that it would work, but it didn't work sometimes. Why? and in terms of being antidepressant.
So
it turns out, the study that we did turns out we discovered that hyperforin is the site collector. That's the one that goes to the site that blocks the depression sets for individuals. But it tags the two volatile flavonoids to make it be able to cross the blood-brain barrier. And the volatile flavonoids aren't even in the plant during the day. They're only in the plant at night.
Isn't it amazing how some of these plants work? It's
and
amazing.
So we, the way I recognized St. John's wort that first alerted to the fact that it might have something to do with the brain for Indina, a company out of Italy, was that I noted that the dyes, the hypericin red dyes, used to, you know, for making dye industry, appeared during the period when growth hormone should be at its highest. And that's when I made the idea that it was a mutated form of growth hormone, and that was why it was red, was to screen out the long heat waves in the Okanagans where it grows prolifically to protect the seed development in the plant. Mm-hmm. And so the dye is highest in the plant during seed production, and the volatile flavonoids are history during the day.
Mm-hmm.
They're not even present in the plant, which means that even if you have a lot of the hyperforin in it, it won't work if it does not have the blood-brain barrier transport process. And so that herb has to be harvested in the middle of the night and dried extremely slowly, like you might a mint, because otherwise the oils in it are gone and the effectiveness won't work. It's an interesting plant. That's the kind of level that I approached plants, where, like, as a scientist, you know, I'd be walking along and I'd get to know the plant where it talks
to you.
You could be doing some wormwood and catnip real easy on your land, you know.
Yeah, I want
to put it up like a hay crop or something.
I'm thinking about trying to come up with a little something that I might be able to farm relatively easy and you know. And
no brainer, yeah. What kind of equipment do you have?
Oh, I got a nice old Ford tractor, and I've got,
Well, you got a swather?
What's that?
A swath. It's a mower, like a rotary mower.
Oh, yeah, I have like a brush hog, yeah.
Yeah, you have a brush hog, okay. That's a little different. That would be maybe another mint might be skullcap in your area. Skullcap grows well. There's world shortages of it right now.
Mm-hmm.
You would rotary mower that with a brush hog, and you'd need a vacuum pickup because you don't dry it in the field.
Uh-huh.
You'd shade dry it on tarps or whatever.
All right, cool.
But rotary mower... How much
do you got to grow? In other words, I mean, you got to grow an acre of it,
don't turn on with anything less than 2 acres.
Uh-huh.
That's a good place to start. It's
right.
A 2 acre field, because you've got to turn your equipment around, and that's going to give you an overhead.
Right.
You know, that's meaningful. Gardening is a different matter. You could put up greens and use a Kubota type rice harvester and sell the grains to floral trade. You could dye them. You could do all kinds of things with them. You know, that's a simple thing, you know, growing bearded wheat or whatever, and you know, at full stage. Of course, Missouri is famous for growing wheatgrass, which is used in the green movement, you know, Van Wigmore and those things.
Right.
That's where you would cut your rotary mower your wheat in an early stage before it formed the heads. And that's what wheatgrass is. And,
cool.
So there's, you know, you have lots of possibilities.
Right.
It's just tuning in to what the soil wants to grow best, and that would be the weed that you'd look at. You've got burdocks there. You've got all kinds, and the greater burdock is used in Chicago in the Asian markets like we would carrots. I mean, you know, you could grow the burdock, just rake it out with a moldboard plow or, you know, a potato plow, and out you come. The equipment will often dictate what's in the neighborhood, will dictate also what is easy for you to grow, because, of course, you don't want to go out and have to buy a combine or, these things.
Right.
And so you share crop. And share cropping is when you've got a couple neighbors and they have other equipment that they're not using at that moment, you know, because of timing, and you grow a crop that requires that during a period when the normal use of that equipment is not being done, and you have a way to form a little cooperative, sharecropping your that's what we used to do up in the Okanagans. None of us had any money, and so we had equipment, and we swapped it around, helping each other farm different things, which was what led me to think about the how to, you know, how to determine what you really want to grow. Markets are really important, of course, and of course, as you may or may not know, the herb trade went down into a big black hole for the last 7 years.
Yeah, a couple, I was going to say 5 years ago maybe?
Yeah, seven. Actually, it was when Andrew Weil got on 60 Minutes and Ed Bradley busted him across by saying, well, you don't know goat turds from pork and beans, do you? And Andrew Weil just sat there and blinked. Because they had done some due diligence on some of the herb businesses that he thought were the best in the country. And Bradley went out and found out that, no, they weren't very good at all, and that Andrew Weil said to Andrew Weil on 60 Minutes, you recommend herbs to, and millions of people listen to you, and you don't know what you're talking about. And that's when the big black eye occurred across the board with credibility on the use of herbs.
But it's also probably something that, in the long term, is probably a good thing, because it's sort of you get a shakeout, and the people who are in the biz,
Yes, that part, yes. The bad part is it didn't shake out. The pharmaceutical took over the herb trade. It's now business as usual, and I'm leaving. I got into it.
Well, hey, look. Let's take a quick break, okay?
Sure.
All right, and we'll come back in just a minute. We got so much to talk about, but I need to take a quick one here, and we'll come back with Richard Allen Miller. Thanks, Richard. Okay, we'll be back in just a second. All right, everybody, on the web, www.mikehagan.com. You can connect over there to Richard's website, which is www.nwbotanicals.org. That's Northwest Botanicals, but just nwbotanicals.org. And you can link over there from my site from here on out, okay? All right, we'll be back with Richard in just a minute or so. Got a quick one here from Marcy Playground. Cool song called Blood in Alphabet Soup. I love it. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Richard Allen Miller. In Alphabet Soup. That's Marcy Playground. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. Thank you to Barnhouse Crazy Music, 125 South A Street, right downtown, for helping with KOPN's Audiodacious Gallery event. Information on Barnhouse Crazy Music can be found on the web at crazymusiconline.com. www.kopn.com or by phone 573-445-0000. Okay, let's get right back to it with our guest for this evening, Richard Allen Miller, on the web at nwbotanicals.org. Richard, we were talking about shamanism, and of course it's a natural move into plants. Shamans and plants sort of go together, and you know a hell of a lot about plants. How are things with Northwest Botanicals? What's the primary
work
that
we're going to start up our cone harvests next week. We're going to do probably 80. We have one purchase order for 80 truckloads of ponderosa pine cones.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, what do people use ponderosa pine cones for?
Oh, wreathing and decorative, floral.
Hmm. Yeah.
Anytime you see a cone, it probably came from us.
Very interesting.
Yeah. The that song you just played was really interesting. You know, the structure of it and some of the wording comes from the Beatles.
Yes, these guys are great. This band,
I know,
and
I am the walrus. Good for you, man.
That's right.
I could see it all there.
I'm glad you noticed.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. I've got a couple things that came up at the break there. A local guy here in Missouri called and said, ask Richard if he knows if we could make an ayahuasca analog. He said if there's a DMT containing vine or root or something that grows here in Missouri, because we got all these big
crab
vines
grass.
Here.
You can titrate it with lemons.
Crabgrass.
Yeah, there's recipes on dimethyltryptamine. You know, dimethyltryptamine has a lot of different analogs. You know, there's N,N-dimethyltryptamine, there's 5-alpha.
5-alpha,
yeah, there's
methoxy,
all, these,
all these
and
different.
They all are different.
Mm-hmm.
My ex-wife, yes.
So which is the one that, for example, the I mean, is there one particular one that ayahuascaros use,
well,
or are there a bunch of different ones?
Ayahuasca is usually a formula of a bunch of things,
right,
including
right.
your dimethyltryptamine, and each mm-hmm. one is different,
mm-hmm.
and often predicated on which shaman is being jealous. The other ones are going to try to murder him, you know, that kind of thing. Because they've got that. The formulas on ayahuasca, I would rather go straight to dimethyltryptamine. I was at a rave a few years back when I got back into writing in physics. I wrote a paper called, for this rave, Synthetic Telepathy in the Early Mind Wars. And they had Crystal Springs in there playing. And this guy from Montana, Johnny Appleseed, came in with a bunch of Flores and cooked it down for those that wanted the journey. Clark Heinrich was there doing his mushroom thing. You know,
he's the guy who wrote Strange Fruit.
Yeah, well, he's got a new one out on sacred mushrooms where he actually has pictures showing the Pope painting their forehead with this stuff so it goes right straight through. It's called the Pope's Cradle. And I have to tell you, I'm too old for this.
Oh, it's crazy. Yeah, there's so much stuff that's being revealed about how things have been working. It's amazing. You know?
On the Catholic Church, you mean?
Oh, it's on so many things, but the Vatican certainly, yeah.
Yeah, let me tell you, a friend of mine in New York wrote a book on the witch burnings of France.
Mm-hmm.
And every single witch burning could be traceable to ergot poisoning from the bakery.
Wow.
It gets better. The Catholic Church at that time, and he does that as his final chapter, shows proof that the Catholic Church was actually using this ergot in rituals 100 years before, and that they were condoning the witch burnings based on trying to control the public. And you know what? That's happening today.
Damn right.
With 9/11 and the Pentagon. You know the Pentagon wasn't hit by an airplane, and you know that Bush didn't win the election. Mm. What does that mean? It means our mind control experiments are working, huh?
Mm, the stuff you were working on 30 years ago, they've actually implemented, yeah.
Yeah, but crabgrass would be, there's a whole host of different things from, some of your sages. I think there's Dalmatian white sage, what is it? It's a, there's other sages that have small quantities of this. Actually, crabgrass has either dimethyltryptamine, the one you want, NN,
mm-hmm.
or it has DIMI. And you won't know that until you do a simple thin layer chromatography, which you can do, by the way, with some paint, spray paints at the back end of your truck. You can determine what crabgrass is which. And once you've identified that, then that's the one you cultivate.
And what, okay, so and So what do you do with it? In other words, DMT is in lots and lots of different plants and animals. It's all over the place.
Yeah.
But what do you do with it? I mean, you can't eat the crabgrass because it'll DMT gets beaten up by the gut or whatever, right?
Well, that's right. So you titrate it with lemons.
Okay. What does that mean?
Titrating means that you separate your dimethyltryptamines using a titration format of lemon, the citric acid.
So what,
and
you soak
it in
lemon?
The citric acids will titrate it, and then the brew that you have will be digested differently than if you were to just eat the crabgrass. You
and
know
it's
those,
actually orally active. It actually works.
That's correct.
Really?
Actually, you know, those cows out there, those bovine that are eating, chewing their cud,
right,
they're having close encounters, actually.
Well, that's why they just keep their heads down all day, huh?
Well, No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. But that Trout, who was his editor of Ethnogen Review.
Yeah, Ethnogen Review, yeah.
Yeah, he said to me once, you know, Rick, some plants aren't really plants. They're delivery systems from God.
And isn't that the truth?
I find it extremely interesting that one of the most important brain chemistries that come out of the visual cortex of the cerebral cortex, you know, the visual centers of the cerebral cortex, is dimethyltryptamine. And the fact that it is in
human
almost all plants, there's something else going on here than what we understand in our relationship to the plant world.
Well, what do you make of that, that DMT is actually in human metabolism, that somehow, and, I mean, do they even know where it's made? I know the pineal has been sort of
it's
considered.
It's the pineal gland. It's where it
so that's
it
where
originates.
Yeah. That's where it originates. Okay.
Visual cortex. And that is seeing the light.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
is it related
I
to the dream?
You,
is it related to dream time and all this?
Well, dream time is, you mean from Trabiander and Hopi. yeah, that, because the way it's...
Richard, you're really smart. I love that.
You know, it's not like it's being taught today. Dream time is different.
Right.
But the Hopi, that was Grandfather Joseph that was doing that, even before Thomas Banacha. He was the... Okay. Grandfather Joseph said that the light that one sees in one's dreams are the key toward immortality. It was, in fact, we're now, Rick Strassman is the one doing most of the studies now on dimethyltryptamine.
Right, I've interviewed him, yeah.
And his work is monumental in showing, and Persinger, I don't, let's not leave Persinger out there, that...
I'm not familiar, actually, with...
Persinger is up in Ottawa. He's the one doing all the brain studies.
Oh, yeah. He's actually, okay, I remember now. He's actually a friend of McKenna, Dennis McKenna's buddy.
Well,
of mine, so.
Now, Persinger's works are actually even more interesting in some ways. I've known these guys for a long time, and because, of course, what I did was I was your Navy's lead scout. I went out to find these people.
Yeah.
And make those studies formal so that we, do we continue with this or we just dissipate it and go in a different path?
Was it worthwhile or should we, yeah.
That's what I was about. I did that in 1970. And so I've been doing this a long time. And the reason I went into herbs is because there's just something really wonderful about getting your hands in the dirt and talking to it. You know, Michael Razia is a quantum computation algorithm. It is. Probably Gaia. It is. Michael Razia in the soil is your habitat of viruses and bacteria and, mycelium and conglomerate. And it has a uniqueness like Chicago is unique over
San Francisco.
New York City. It has a kind of personality. And that's the way I've approached agriculture. I get a sense of it. But the mycorrhizae as a complex is a conscious entity that may be the mother. Literally. Now, with that said, then you have these different plants that have this extremely complex, rare dimethyltryptamine. By the way, when Moore was studying it in the lab next to me, it was called telepathy.
That
was right. It was all based off of Andrea Puharich's work.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And so Yeah,
he was a creepy dude. Jeez.
He was my teacher in parapsychology.
Oh God, that guy creeped me out, man.
Yeah, well, Andrei Shuharich, he was from Israel, and he was a rigorous son of a gun. He was very good and taught me a way of approaching the paranormal, which was, you know, gave me an edge as a scientist. Today, I haven't got a clue what it all means yet. I'm still searching just like you are.
Right.
I don't know. But the crabgrass is the ones that, you know, the real crabgrass, the Phalaris varieties. In fact, there are probably 7 or 8 different cultivars and species of Phalaris that will have a dimethyltryptamine in it, the NN dimethyltryptamine. Tom Lytle, a very good friend of mine, had psychedelic essays and monographs. I've published a lot of my stuff in his works, and has written extensively about ecstasy and some of the other related to dimethyltryptamine. Dimethyltryptamine is probably a drug, or, I mean a neurotransmitter for immortality. I believe that seeing the light is a release of dimethyltryptamine in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And it being produced in the brain rather than taking it from external sources is obviously the way you want to focus your studies.
Yeah. Okay, so let me ask you about that then. When people take DMT externally, whether they smoke it or whether they take it in
ayahuasca,
right? What all they're really doing is changing the levels of the endogenous stuff that's there anyway, right?
Well, naturally, what's probably really happening is like with LSD, where the actual antigen that's going in is combated by the brain's own chemistry, and the relationship is that the brain then starts producing its own stuff, counter homeopathy, and that the, like LSD, is completely out of the body within 20 minutes of ingestion.
Yeah,
it's in the urine, all broken down.
I mean, it's just a mystery that something's... I mean, the scientists said, well, my God, the fact that somebody could actually feel 50 micrograms or whatever, that blew everyone away for a long time anyway. The fact that you could take so little of it and it had an effect.
That's right. And, of course, I don't know if you've ever done 5-alpha, but that's what Negadev and some of the others discussed, was the creepy part, because you had close encounters. That's one of the reasons Navy was looking at that at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was a gateway drug, like BZ, that could, when a veteran took it...
And that was what, 5-alpha DMT?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And BZ was another one.
A weird one, too.
Jacob's Ladder drug, yeah. Uh-huh. We found...
People didn't realize that was real.
Well, the thing was, what would happen is that reality changed for other people that were not taking it. How does that work?
That reminds me of Tim Leary. What did you say about LSD? It causes psychotic behavior in people who haven't taken it.
Well, how did Tim actually put it? He said, the very worst possible thing that could happen is that you come out the same way you went in. That's the way I remember Tim,
right,
was that he was, again, one of my teachers again.
Mm-hmm.
His work was, and I don't want to forget this one. That little toady Andrew Weil we were talking about,
mm-hmm,
he's the one that got Leary kicked out of Harvard.
2 years, right.
And so,
I wonder,
you know,
if he was a plant. I wonder if he was a plant to begin with.
What's that?
I wonder if the whole thing was a setup to begin with. You know?
No, Leary studies.
No, I mean Weil. I mean,
oh,
I wonder,
Andrew Weil?
Yeah, I wonder if he was a plant to begin with.
I'm not going to speculate.
That's funny, the word plant, by the way.
Yeah, plant, yeah, I gotcha. Anyway. The metaphor. The thing is, the studies that are now being done, I have a friend who is a medical doctor, he's a lawyer, and he's a psychotherapist, PhD,
mm-hmm,
obviously he's Jewish, and he advocates the use of LSD therapy, like Kubler-Ross and some of the others.
Yeah. Let me ask you about this. You know, last year, June or July, there was a major report that came out of Johns Hopkins on psilocybin.
Yes, the psilocybin and psilocin and psilocybin are not as interesting in terms of impact. They're more of a body thing. Yes, they can use that in therapy because of kinesiology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has the worm key corrections that you deal with. I don't know if you're familiar with those studies, but that has to do with the Mars Project and some of the other conspiracies out there that are interesting. But really, I'm going to say that the mushrooms help the body remember. You know, the body is also a memory holder.
Sure,
and
sure.
So that's
pretty much everything
physiology.
That's ever happened on this planet, essentially.
Right.
At least in the biological sense.
So I'm going to suggest that the mushrooms, the psilocybin mushrooms, as a host of, you know, I wrote the first book on psychedelic mushrooms.
That was, tell me.
Magical
what
Mushroom
yeah.
Handbook for High Times.
Huh, wonderful. When was that? That was like in the early 70s too.
Early, yeah. Mm-hmm. The magical and ritual use of herbs originally was written to keep those 28 herbs out of the Uniform Controlled Substance Act.
Whoa, this is important. We need to talk about this
and be clear about it.
And
the psilocybin that's in my book, because it was in my book, means, and this is a very important point of law.
Listen up, people.
Oh, well, it's not that important.
It is.
That you can grow, legally grow, psilocybin mushroom. They'll try to threaten you. They'll make you confess, blah, blah, blah. But they have to show either intent for sale, not the volume you're growing. They have to show that you sold it or that you are extracting psilocin and psilocybin mm-hmm. chemistries. But if you're growing psilocybin, it is a sacrament, and like peyote and some of the others, has that freedom of individual growth. I believe
and you
like
can
crabgrass
share it.
Is the same way.
And you can share it. In other words, as long as you don't sell it.
Sharing it is a questionable area. I'm not even going to suggest at this point.
All right.
You know, giving it away like apple seed does, maybe.
Yeah.
There's ways of covertly. But I have to say that psilocybin is a real newcomer and mostly was not used by North American Indians as much as it was further south
right,
in Mexico.
Right, Mexico and
we have
South America.
We have some varieties. I discovered Biocystis was growing up in Bellingham. We had Liberty Caps in just
all over the place.
Yeah,
it's amazing that the indigenous people up there didn't use them.
Well, they had other things they were using. They were in Amanita. You know, they were using all kinds of things.
Really? The Amanita grows under all the pine trees there.
It grows on the beaches mostly. That's where you'll find it. Is in near the ocean, in the forests, and pine forests, yes. But you have other species of Amanita that are deadly poison.
Oh, that's a bitch trying to figure out Amanita because you got to know where.
Well, that's
when,
really
and how
easy. If it's red, it's probably okay, and you've got to understand the chemistry of the Amanita to be careful with it because.
But don't they even change a lot, like seasonally and locationally,
that's
and
correct.
All this?
Yes, that's correct. It has two primary chemistries. There's muscimol and muscarine, and they attack, if you will, they attack the central nervous system differently, and so that means that they're going in opposite directions, and the hallucinations that you have are from the limited balancing of those two, and that if one is higher than the other one, you could be killing yourself, and that was probably what Heinrich and some of the others called the sacred mushroom. By the way, I think Heinrich's book is well beyond Gordon Wasson's book on that subject. Mm-hmm.
You know who John Marco Allegro was, the guy?
Yes,
the Dead
I know
Scrolls
Allegro. Yeah. Hmm?
Yeah, I interviewed his daughter. Judith Ann Brown is her name, and she wrote a book called John Marco Allegro, the Maverick of the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's called. And she talks about all of his ideas, you know, about this connection of Christianity with the mushroom and all this stuff.
Allegro wrote about Brujo sorcery and some of the further south stuff, too, I remember.
He was remarkable.
Well, he was, you know, ahead of his time, like Mercy Eliade. Mercy Eliade was teaching at the University of Chicago, and when I got a chance to, I spent a couple of years in correspondence with him. I didn't actually take courses from him like I did some of the other people. I studied with Gershom Scholem like for 6 years on the Kabbalah.
Yeah.
So, but they're all through all of the literature. These sacred plants have always had a place in the upper elite. I remember magic was reserved for the ultra elite of Europe for centuries, and it wasn't until Aleister Crowley started using drugs as a form of ritual magic, that it fell out of vogue or respect. But I have to tell you, taking a mind-altering drug is actually a performing an act of literal magic.
Magic, yes.
That is, in fact, what magic is. It's the art of changing consciousness at will. Mm-hmm. And when you, that's your syntactic modes where you're using biofeedback and you know, tools. You're going specifically for a state.
Right, and language and sound, all this is a big part of it.
Yeah, cymatics, you betcha. Mm-hmm. That's all of it is important. I'm going to come back into this universe and start writing about this because I've written all the books on herbs. I've got over 300 monographs that have not seen the light of day. If people are interested in knowing how to grow echinacea or some of these other things, you can find these monographs on the website herbfarminfo.com.
Yeah, okay, herb. We'll put a link up for that too.
Okay. Herb. Well, it just shows there's you know, the growing of herbs. That's where I started, was doing all the study of herbs, and then I came up with a hot flash when I was into the farming that, you know, a lot of the herbs that are imported into the United States could be grown
here. Right here. Of course.
Hemp, all of it.
Oh, all right, Richard, top of the hour, got to take a break, okay?
Yes, sir.
We'll come back, and I do want to talk about hemp, and I want to talk about, I want to clarify right at the end of the segment here that, you know, psilocybin mushrooms can be grown. All you have to do is know how to defend yourself, apparently, because there are a lot of people that are actually getting arrested for this sort of thing, but don't know what you just said.
Yeah, the laws. Yeah.
All right, very important stuff. Okay, Richard, thanks. We'll be back in a minute, okay?
Yes, sir.
All right, everybody, Richard Alan Miller, wonderful stuff. Thanks for being on the program with us here, Richard, and you can find out about the man himself, Richard Alan Miller, on the web at www.northwestbotanicals. It's nwbotanicals.org. And, of course, you can just go over to my site and link over there just as easily. And we'll have this program in the archives in 24 hours or so. And we'll have all of Richard's information there in the program archives. So you can link over to his sites and listen to the show and share it with other people, hopefully, if you think it warrants. All right? Okay, it's Mike, and it is Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, just a couple of minutes after 1 a.m. now on May Day, Beltane, as it were, first day of summer in many older traditions, and welcome to it. Happy summer. Hope you guys have a great one, and let's play a little bit of... not the most summertime-ish music, but I'm sorry. It has to be done. This is called Death of a Cheerleader. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. This is Marcy Pygram.
She was so pretty, everyone said. More so the pity that she was found dead. Now the flag only flies 50% in the schoolyard where she once went. Pushing back, way back, B-E-A-G-G-R-E-S-S-I-V-E. And the death of a cheerleader takes me by surprise. How the death of a cheerleader can open eyes. Yellow carnations and roses galore were sent to the mother and placed by the door. And in the spot where her daughter had taken her life was a sweet 16 photo on homecoming night. Pushing back, way back, B-E-A-G-G-R-E-S-S-I-V-E. the death of a cheerleader takes me by surprise. How the death of a cheerleader can open eyes. And it's sad that she had to die to open eyes. Nobody noticed she grew up so fast. It's a shame that her future's a thing of the past. Tomorrow's the funeral, you know. L-E-T-S-G-O.
Marcy Playground, that's called Death of a Cheerleader. All the stuff you're hearing tonight is from a CD called MP3. Great stuff from Reality Entertainment. Thanks so much for making it available to us and allowing me to share it with other people. Wonderful independent music. And you can check it all out on the web, www.MikeHagan.com. Really cool cutting stuff, man. How about those lyrics? These guys are great. Okay, let's get right back to Richard Allen Miller with us from his place in Oregon, and we thank him for sticking up late into the night with us. Thanks so much, Richard.
You betcha. I'm enjoying the music.
Thank you.
You've picked good music. You're a good spin doctor.
I appreciate it. Thanks a lot. Well, right at the edge of the break last time, you mentioned hemp, and I had it on my list of things. A couple people have mentioned it. Again, this is a Missouri.
You bet.
The Missouri thing as well, and there's actually, you know, a
Paw Valley Hemp Peckers Association. I remember that.
Well, also, I'm not sure if you're aware, but you know, there's a bill in Congress right now that was introduced in February. Believe it or not, by Ron Paul, one of the guys who's running for president. He's a Republican, believe it or not, from Texas.
Yeah.
I mean,
I don't believe that part, though.
Yeah, libertarian in Republican clothes or something. But anyway, this bill, the 2007 Industrial Hemp Farming Act. What's that all about? Do you know?
Well, yeah, the United States has a history of producing hemp.
Of course.
In the 30s, during the war, when we were at war with Germany, which is where a lot of our botanicals came from, we had to start growing our own. And hemp is probably one of the six top used herbs in the world.
And it's been cultivated for thousands of years, probably.
It's even more than that. We used it in our studies when I worked Lunar Base Alpha 1. Hemp was one of the projects, crops of the six that we selected to see what would happen if we grew it on the moon. That means with unscreened, filtered lights. And that's where we discovered Grolux. In fact,
trying to grow hemp on the moon?
I have a High Times did an interview on me called Growing Pot on the Moon.
That's awesome.
February issue, 1992, and it talks about my work with Lunar Base Alpha 1, where we were growing. We had a Sammamish Slough was our variety that we were growing, and it was got to be the most killer weed ever grown, literally, and that was done at Boeing.
You got any seeds?
Huh? It doesn't work for seed. It's polyploid. Sorry about that. But I can help you in that. The Mammoth Slough was where we learned how to clone the indigenous from the mother block. And the plant now is 37 years old. You cannot believe a pot plant that's 37 years old. It's a big stump with a bunch of couple hundred. It's in eastern Washington now. It had to be moved several times.
And it lives inside, outside? What
it's an indoor,
right?
Strictly controlled environment.
Okay.
And
and it's been alive and growing for 37 years.
Yeah, there's
and does it go through fruiting cycles and everything?
No, we don't grow that plant. We just grow the rootstock and we clone on
I
the bud.
I see.
The bud from
because that was the mother, huh?
That's the mother block. Yeah, that's what they call a mother block. And what when I went to Amsterdam, I got to meet Jacobs that runs the Marijuana Museum. His wife runs the Sensi Seed Bank. And first thing he did when
I've
I was in
there.
Amsterdam.
Yeah,
he came up to me and he handed me this big package of marijuana. And I said, what is this? And he said, it's a gift for visiting our country. And I looked at this bud, and I said, this looks like Josephine County's bubblegum. And he fell over backwards.
He knew it.
Selected one that had come from Josephine County, where I live. We, I had married someone from the Selma cartel. Selma is where they grow a lot of the pot. And so we call the wild men out there, the outlaws, we call them the cartel.
That's
the
in
Selma
Oregon?
Cartel.
In Oregon?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, southern Oregon here.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, every year you can watch, they have a body count in the newspaper on how many plants bit the dust that day. And you know what that's all about is because of the Oaxacan shit that comes in that was used to wrap black tar heroin, and it was interfering because these local lodi toads were trying to make land payments or something, and that's what they were doing, growing this pot. It wasn't like a big commercial thing.
Right.
It just was done really well.
Right. What do you make of it? Just the laws and where things are going. I mean, the fact that
this is a fascist state.
This is absolutely outrageous. I mean, the fact that you can't grow hemp, that you even have to have a bill in Congress to somehow make it legal.
Well, there are a bunch of states that allow that law, but it's the federal government that's at odds. And so in Oregon, for example, I have a marijuana growing permit. I can grow my own marijuana because I have bad darm, you know, with pain.
Right.
But the feds did a big bust in California with all these people that were dying of cancer that were using it because the marijuana is, for me, like, for example, I'm a very hyper person. I'm wired a little differently than most.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a, you know, whiz kid. And because of that, I have found that rather than do Ritalin or some of these other terrible drugs, that a small puff will make me normal.
Mm-hmm.
And, semi-normal. I'm never going to ever be, you know, just kidding. But I'm trying to say that Alaska had those laws, Oregon, of course, and now I think Colorado and Arizona. There are other states now that have legalized marijuana with permits, you know, from a medical doctor, but it's still against federal
law. Right.
And so there is this, you know, possibility of the state having to battle the feds. And that's probably why we're going to secede from the union. Who knows? I'm kidding. There are a lot of survivalists and Klan and that kind of thing out where I live. And I am used to being, most people that live in a country are outlaws. They're not criminals,
right, yeah.
But they have their own drum they beat to on what's right, what's wrong. What you do in the privacy of your own home, what you do on your own land, should not have any interference at all mm-hmm. with federal laws.
I agree fully.
But, of course, we're a republic now, and, you know, Bush isn't really even our president. In fact, following that line of thinking, who do you think our president really is? Because it's real obvious. I mean, to me, who the president of the United States is. It's the person that makes all the gunpowder and the plastic for overpackaging. That's DuPont. And I have to say, you know, thinking that Bush is our president, that's crazy. I mean, that's obviously not true, because how could anybody that ignorant run this country like that? But he's got people around him, you know. And the New World Order, it was Dennis Kucinich. By the way, I really like Dennis Kucinich. And he, of all the people, he's probably the only one that I see as a true statesman, one that is caring about what's going on, not about the politics of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wanted to have a Department of Peace. What do you think of that?
Yeah, how about it? Yeah. That'd be
I didn't mean to tangent, but
No, it's good. It's good because all this stuff is relevant. I mean, we're in the middle of the world's sort of in a perilous situation, it seems like. So it's
he's not from Missouri. He's from
Ohio, I think.
Ohio,
right?
Yes. He's from Ohio, next door. You know, you've had some pretty interesting statesmen come out of your area too.
No doubt about it.
And it's just unfortunate what's going on. I have friends up in Canada that are very worried about what the United States is going to do when they determine and discover that the news is wrong, that they've been lying to us, and it isn't at all like we think. In medicine, one of the reasons I came up with mushrooms, just to give you a little intro here, was because, you know, if we're number one in the world for money and research and all the rest of it, why are we number eight in recovery of any form of cancer? That there are actually two countries in Africa that you have a better statistical chance of recovery than you do here in North America because of the way they're treating cancer here. The medical center here is no longer interested in healing. That's one of the reasons I got into herbs, was that it was an alternative to medicine. And now that's all changed. It's now it's just more business as usual. Large corporations have taken over the medicines and the herb trade, and it's like business as usual now in terms of it's not about healing someone. It's about prescriptions and recurring
things. treatment forever. You know, I was in the medical industry for a few years on the equipment side. I worked in the capital equipment side, and but I had plenty of dealings with doctors and hospitals in this whole business for a long time, and oh my God, it's just absolutely frightening.
It's embarrassing in some ways when you realize that most of those people, a medical doctor is not at all the rigor required for someone going into physics. When I worked as a biophysicist.
Which doesn't mean there aren't really good people out there doing good work, but it's just they're in the middle of a system that's very, very, very difficult.
Well, the motivation, the intentionality, the purpose, you know, those things have been lost because, of course, we're into
and
how
the
much
oath.
Money are you making.
And the oath.
Yeah.
You know, to do no harm.
Yeah.
My God.
Well, chemo and radiation are killers.
Lord
and,
mercy, I know.
For anybody to do that as a first option, that's nuts. I mean, that's crazy, because even in Jungian psychotherapy, they would suggest that most illnesses are a result of the subconscious mind not being able to get your attention. Once you've got what you're trying to say to yourself, there's no need for the illness, and it usually dissipates.
Right. I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've had weird things where illnesses or symptoms go away almost immediately.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like.
And treating a symptom is not the correct approach toward any kind of illness you know, to immediately suggest that you've got congestion, so you need a decongestant, let's take some ephedra. That's crazy because, in fact, ephedra will cause, it's a bronchial dilator, it will cause you to lose the elasticity in your blood vessels. That's what happens to people that are using meth. They'll at some point, there'll be a breakdown in the flexibility of the blood capsule, you know, your blood vessels.
Yeah, because they've been kept open wide so long. Yeah.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And they lose that elasticity,
right.
And basically, you know, allergies are easily controlled by reprogramming the parasympathetic nervous system.
Please enlighten me and all the other people here in Missouri that are miserable right now. I've had, and I only recently, the last few years, and I'm 42, but I had no allergies or anything for, you know, the great majority of my life. But in the last 3 or 4 years, I definitely feel it. What do I do? What do we do?
That's easy. I used to have allergies, too, and I got rid of them. And how you do it is to first realize that it is your body's overreaction to an allergen that causes the allergies in the first place. And once you've understood that, it's a release of histamines. Once you've realized that, then you go through a deprogramming of how fast you release histamines. And how you do that is that when you've been exposed to an allergen, there is a 10-minute window between when you know you're going to have a problem with your eyes and snifflies and when it actually happens. And during that 10-minute window, you lay down on your back, you roll your eyes back up into your head in an alpha state,
mm-hmm.
and you put a cold compress, a cold washcloth across the eyes and nose of the sinuses. And that only takes one time, maybe two at the most, and you are going to no longer be bothered by allergies, because what you've done is reprogrammed the release of the histamines. You've turned, you, like a snake bite, you're trying to slow it down, and that's done.
Right on. All right. I hope people remember that. And
it's just it's a way to do it. You can do it with hypnosis, you know, going to a hypnotherapist.
Mm-hmm.
But really, this is something that you can do yourself.
Right.
And the allergen is not what is causing the allergy. What it is your body's mm-hmm. over-response. And so going back to our original theme on that,
mm-hmm.
to give your chlorothymetron or some of these other medicines that are used actually exacerbate it and make it worse. That doesn't help it. It just helps you sleep that night. But newsflash, your body is now learning that it requires that in order to go into homeostasis.
All right, well, here's a big related one, though. So for people who have children, who have allergies, and the children may not be able to recognize what you're talking about.
Takes the child, immediately lays them down, and talks to them slowly with her hand on her forehead with a cold compress across their eyes, and tries to make the child relax,
mm-hmm.
going into an alpha state. If the child does that, the histamines are released slower. That tells the body to release the histamine slower,
mm-hmm.
and it will then have memory of releasing
histamine
slower.
I gotcha. Now, this 10-minute window, how do you recognize it?
Between being exposed and you sneeze and you haven't got the itchy nose and the itchy eyes yet.
Uh-huh. Okay,
it's so that 10-minute, that's what, the itchy eyes and the sniffly nose, that's all histamines.
Right.
And so what you're trying to do is stop the release
slow down
of the histamine.
Not take a
like
bunch of antihistamines, right.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I gotcha. Okay, wonderful stuff. Okay. Let's see. What else you want to talk about?
Well, we can go anywhere you want to.
You said snake bite. Can you talk at all about cordyceps?
I can talk to you about Cordyceps sinensis and the hybridization of it. It's probably in the 35 years that I have been. Thank you for asking, by the way, Michael.
Yeah, sure.
In the 35 years I've been restricted. In the 35 years I've been in the herb trade, I've watched the soup du jour. You know, every year it's something new. Maca, horny goatweed. Geez, the list goes on. Every year it's something new, you know.
Right.
One year it was echinacea. Another year,
St. John's wort, I remember that.
Yeah. Okay. Now, they're all interesting. Some are much more interesting than others. But I have never, in the 35 years, with my way of looking at world, I've never seen anything like these pharmaceutical mushrooms. And that would include the reishi, the maitake, the shiitake. The list goes on. There's probably more than 50 mushrooms now that would fall into the category of pharmaceutical. The cordyceps grows in Tibet as a native. It also grows in Oregon, by the way.
Really? Native?
Yeah, there's a variety of species.
Cool.
Yeah. But the Cordyceps sinensis is a little tiny mushroom that grows off of dead insects, and is the primary reason why insects don't get cancer. What the mushroom does, it has several chemistries in it. The one that I like as most interesting is not the beta-glucans, like your cordyceptin, your cordyceptic acid, those things, but the polysaccharides. What a polysaccharide is a long, great big long sugar molecule with more than 100 oxygen molecules in it. And as the sugar molecule breaks, oxygen is released on a cellular level, and it kills cancer, because cancers cannot exist in an oxygen-rich environment.
Right.
Now, that means it also works for stuff like HIV, works like or will work in animals. I mean, the clinical studies, what I can talk about are clinical studies with animals, and it's remarkable. A lot of rehab for abused animals use the cordyceps now as a way to recover the dog. I have been eating it personally myself. I take upward of 4 grams a day. I just shovel it down. I eat it out of a tin, 1 kilo tin, rather than taking it as a capsule. Nick Begich, it markets it on his site as eighth element. He has the element series, you know, for monoatomic gold and some of the other things he's doing. He markets that as eighth element, the Cordyceps sinensis. The hybridization of it is when rattlesnake venom is injected into the mycelium at a critical stage, causing it to mutate into a hybrid form that includes 5.4 times normal polysaccharides found in nature. That's like taking maize and turning it into corn so our mandibles and digestive system can eat the corn. Modifying it for man by injecting diamondback rattler venom in it. And actually, it makes it a true snake oil then. Ha ha ha. Well, I'm kidding. But snake venom is a very simple chemistry that breaks down completely in the mycelium. But in doing so, it causes polysaccharides to form, these sugar molecules. And that, in my opinion, is where the benefit of this mushroom comes from, is these polysaccharides. When you can put oxygen in on a cellular level to the body, there is no way that anything wrong can occur. Cancers, what it does is it causes the turgoring of your cell. It puffs up, and if it's cancerous, it's going to blow apart. It'll destroy cancer cells. And what we're doing now is in feedlots, we're adding transfer factor, and now the cordyceps mushroom and the transfer factor in combination work better than an antibiotic in feedlots. And that is a revolutionary break, because if we can make our food chain healthier, well, that's the way that works.
You and I were talking about soil the other day and about how important healthy soil is in order to have healthy things.
It has to be alive. You know, that's the whole idea of biodynamics and Mollis and some of the things he was doing. You know, the soil organisms are, you know, they're not necessarily bad. Nematodes, thrips, some of these things have a purpose for being bad to the soil. And what happens is you form an aggregate of dialogue between certain kinds of plants and how they live in more friable organic soils. And the dialogue going on in a soil, if it's alive. I watched a woman at Acres USA once. Chuck Walters had brought her in from Switzerland, and she showed soil that essentially looked like it's cement. I mean, it was dead. It was chunky and nothing was growing it. And less than 7 years, by injecting certain kinds of organisms into the soil, she was able to make that into something that was alive and healthy and thriving for plant growth. Now, a lot of research on that is being done here in Oregon up at Corvallis. There's a woman up there that has been spearheading the studies on mycorrhizia. And that's when I got involved. My first sense was that it was a quantum computation algorithm, like a supercomputer, because of the way salts and information in the soil are moved from one point to another via these organisms and electromagnetic fields.
Man.
Bill Callahan talks about that too.
Gosh, Rick, it reminds me of when I was in the rainforest in Mexico. And
so, right.
And one of the guys I was with said, well, it's not the rainforest, it's the brain forest.
That's right.
And he talked about all of the root systems and everything underneath the ground and what was going on down there. And maybe you could talk a little bit more about this mycorrhizal relationship between, like, mycelium, for example, and how they have relationships with
Mycelium is one part of the mycorrhizia. The mycorrhizia are your viruses and your soil organisms all working like a habitat. Like, Chicago is a unique personality over New York, as I said. Well, so is the Olympic rainforest over the boreal forest up in Canada.
Sure.
They're uniquely different, like your rainforest that you experienced. And for him to call it a brain forest, that's a great concept. I have to say that I'm going to incorporate that. That's a good one. Because, in fact, that's not a bad metaphor. In fact, that is, it's alive. In fact, how deep could you have gone with living? Did you know that in a teaspoon of soil, there's more than 200,000 different life forms.
My God.
It's amazing when you start to realize how life is in everything. And it's in everything. And that it has ways of communicating. You know, I was reminded of this article on nanotechnology where they had injected iron into the body to help the MRI scans. And it was causing cell damage. And what was happening was that iron in a nanometer-sized particle was cruising through the cell and disrupting the chatter, the electromagnetic chatter of the cell communicating to itself like a meteor going through our solar system.
Right.
It was
right, and it's an electromagnetic effect.
Yeah, that's correct. Uh-huh. And that's based on my work on the holographic concept of reality. And I felt that there's a similar metaphor going on with soil and man and everything. That's why I call it a holographic universe, because as above, so below. There's a metaphor there. Now, mycorrhizia...
And Richard had that idea before Michael Talbot and all these other guys, too, I might say. This was...
The only reason I wasn't in Tobin's book was that the holographic universe was that all my work was classified top secret at the time. When I was working in the Navy, and I was their primary in mind control stuff, and so, and we were using that paper. In Tom Lytle's Psychedelic Essays and Monographs, he publishes, that's the only place where embryonic holography was published. It was classified top secret for 20 years, and Tom published that in his Psychedelic Monographs and Essays, saying it was probably one of the more important papers ever written, because in that paper, I suggest that, and that was written in 1973, even before, I suggest that the DNA in our body is a three-dimensional hologram of force space. And now, 35 years later, 40 almost, I'm now writing that the brain is a four-dimensional hologram of five space. You can change the movie by where you set up shop. And your dimethyltryptamine, these are tools that I call power tools. That's a new book I wrote, Power Tools for the 21st Century, of which there's foods, there's breathing exercises. You know, that chapter is called The Quan of Air, and it's The Quan of Air, and it's a chapter on continuous breathing and virtual audio, which are virtually different subjects, but they're the same the way I connect them in my book. And these are ways that we can take these terrible, terrible weapons that we've used for the last 35 years. Project Solo came out of my synthetic telepathy work. It can use this now for the evolution of consciousness. Mm-hmm. It's like using radiation or nuclear energy first as a weapon, and now we're going to use it in medicine. And it takes about 30 years to go from being a weapon to something that could be used for mankind.
All right. Well, look, let's take another break here, okay?
You betcha.
And I'll ask you a little bit more about that. I think when we come back, I'd like to talk to you about, you know, I'm really not interested in laws that are being passed and this sort of thing. I want to know what you think about what's actually coming. You know, this whole business of 2012 and the fact that technology is going crazy and
collapsing into a singularity.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we'll talk about that when we come back, all right?
You bet.
All right, everybody, it's Richard Allen Miller, and you're listening to it here on Radio Orbit. It's Mike Hagan. You're listening to KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. On the web, by the way, at Northwest Botanicals, nwbotanicals.org, and you can link over there from my site as well. This is a song from Marcy Playground called Sleepy Eyes. And we'll be back in just a few minutes with Richard Allen Miller. It's Mike, you listen to Radio Orbit. Sleepy Eyes, that's Marcy Playground on Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Hey, you know, Richard, they're from Seattle, that band.
Yeah, I grew up in Seattle. I was My ex-wife wrote a paper under the events section called I Married the Wizard of Oz.
I know, I read it on your website.
I know, that's what they called me back then. I was king of the mind warp.
I
worked Navy Intel, and I had a magic bookstore and then a big herb company, and had a bunch of delis down in Pioneer Square. The one in the Pike Street Market is still there, called Tenzing Momo. That's one of my original stores.
That is amazing. All right, well, look, we've got about 15 minutes or so, and we've got people that are trying to call in, and we've got all kinds of questions and comments in the chat room. And I also want you to be able to say anything that you'd like to say. So I've got one question first, and then we'll sort of open it up a little bit. First of all, whoever sends me an email, and I'll look at the timestamp on it, whoever sends me the first email, I take that back, the fifth email, I'll give them a copy of The Modern Alchemist, one of Richard's many, many books, a wonderful one, actually. So, anyway, what do you think's happening? What do you think's coming?
You know, it was Joseph Campbell that said it best.
One
when
of my
he
favorites,
said,
sure.
When you see the kingdom of the Father on earth, the apocalypse has already occurred. It's perpetual in its potential. Now, Kurzweil, one of my favorite writers, writes for Scientific American, has written about us collapsing down into a singularity.
Right.
And what do you think that all means?
Boy,
consciousness. You know, consciousness may be dark matter. That may be what it's all about.
What's interesting, the ratios, they say we don't see 95% of the universe. So
well, yeah,
like
let me give you an example, a more concrete one. I've written a technical paper, not for the public, but it's a technical paper, titled Muon Catalytic Fusion Processes, with special application to adenosine triphosphate. I can show you that that's where cold fusion occurs in the body, is at ATP. And the muon is an elementary particle that's like the electron. It's a negative charge. It is identical to the electron, except that it is it decays into a electron and a neutrino anti-neutrino pair, but it also is 237 times heavier than the electron. Where did that go, that matter? And that's the part of mystery that we're all trying to discover now is what is, if it decays into an electron and a neutrino antineutrino pair, well, that means its mass is the same, but yet more than 237 times more mass is created. I think the muon is what causes the muon in elementary particles. When you look at a hydrogen bubble chamber, is that little squirrel that goes down into a vortex. You know, you see it, rather than shooting off in a ray, it goes down into a spinning vortex. And that vortex turns out to be what Roger Penrose writes about in his twister space theory, where Schomburger suggests that it changes water. Now, how that works exactly is that water is probably our most simplest molecule that has two atoms, two different kinds of atoms, that forms a dipole moment. That charge force, when taken through an acceleration of vortex, causes a weak force radiation called Bremen-Strahlen's radiation, which is very similar to Coriolis forces. And that's what I'm writing about now, is how we have different kinds of water. You know, MIT, one of the places where I did my graduate work, actually has a study now showing that water has seven different basic forms and an eighth octave where it's repeating on itself in terms of dimensional physics. How this is working now, they're taking, you know, with Brown's gas, some of these other forms of cold fusion, what they're doing is they're putting, it creates, the muon creates a very special kind of plasma that has only been seen at the moment of the Big Bang in recorded history. And since time, all our types of elementary particles have changed. And I'm going to suggest that time is related in these processes that Kirvan and some of the others talked about. It's not as we think of it. Remember I said I did some of the first time travel experiments with Navy.
That's right.
When I worked at DuPont, they sent me to graduate school at Delaware under R.B. Murray. And my master's was to measure the difference between excitation emission and electron to VK center luminescence in the nanosecond region. And I used Tektronix's first sample scope that had accuracies where I could measure 4.6 nanoseconds. And, you know, the rise time in electronics is only 10 to the 6, minus 6 seconds, so a milliseconds. And how did they do that? Well, I was able to take a particle and move it 6.6 milliseconds into the future. It was called tunneling. And where I came from, Washington State University, for my undergraduate work, we had a little-known professor from England called Raymond Band of band theory. And he talked about event horizons, precursor waves, and tunneling. And that's where I did my master's, was in the concept of event horizons and moving a particle into the future. I can, 35 years later, I can only imagine what we're doing now.
Amazing.
But the time travel studies are all centered around the muon. And what the muon is, here's the kicker part that I find so interesting. In my junior year in high school, before I went to the Nationals in my senior year with a linear accelerator and all that kind of shit, I wrote a paper called A New Meson Field Theory, and I got honorable mention and the Navy Cruiser Award. And it was in my junior year that the Navy put a big bullseye on me. They walked me all the way through and waited for me to come out of graduate school to do what I did. And I did that for 11 years, and then I went into farming.
That's amazing.
Well, I just thought, you know, it's like 47 years ago I was writing about the muon. At that time, it was called a meson field theory, and now it's not a true meson. It's a muon, and the muon is an elementary particle like the electron and the neutrino. Those are the three basic elementary particles, and the muon has to do with time. We're making muon factories now so that we can create a neutrino factory, which is how we measured water on Mars.
My God.
And those kinds of things.
All right. Look, if anybody wants to call, now's the time, 443-8255. And somebody got that book, I'm sure of that. And in the meantime, a couple of quick questions here. On both sides of the spectrum, what are natural libido enhancers? See if Richard can ask him about that. And then, let's see, do you have an opinion on chemtrails? There's two for you that you can maybe nail really quickly.
Let's start with the first one. The libido, of course, I wrote a book called The Magical and Ritual Use of Aphrodisiacs, How to Have Louder and Longer Orgasms. I guess we'll do a sidebar on that one. And there is nothing, as Tom Robbins put it, well, he said it a little differently, but the finest aphrodisiac in the world is imagination.
There you go.
There is nothing better than that. And with that said, what drugs do, or these herbs, is allow an altered state where you can do something you can't do in conscious state. And that is going to be the magnum opus of all of my writings, are talking about how, you know, like, for example, ESP. I'm doing a workshop in Sedona in June to enhance extrasensory perception. They want to start a certification program like they do with hypnosis, where we measure someone's ability. We put them in a light state of hypnosis. And in that state, we can prove that your ability in guessing increases more than 400 times, that above statistical inference. That means that altered states allow the non-local mind, that part that changes reality. I've written with Nexus Magazine about Schumann's resonance and how there's a dialogue going on between you and the Earth.
And the planet, right.
I'm going to suggest that the non-local mind, when done in an altered state, you can create things that you can't do, like extrasensory perception. Mm-hmm. You can, above statistical inference. That means that the laws of consciousness do not apply.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I call it the non-local mind in a holographic universe, which is a new title I'm also writing.
Mm-hmm.
I have actually a bunch of books coming out this year. Nick Begich is going to publish several of them. Inner Traditions is now negotiating with me for more of my books like the, but they want blocks. They're going to reprint maybe the Modern Alchemist, but they want a couple of companions to go with that. The one I've sent them recently was Pantheon, Archetypal Gods in Daily Living, which is a book on tarot. It's 22
yes.
chapters.
All right. All right. What to do for tears from chemtrails? And do you even buy the whole chemtrail phenomenon?
Of course. There's
okay.
things going on
right.
with chemtrails.
Been spraying us for
course,
years.
With their attempt to try to reflect light back, just pray for rain.
Mm-hmm.
I can't use it then. I think that there's chemical dumping going on there, just like there is in the Ozarks. You know, it's whenever you have that. Well, space is the air. The volume of space is so huge
yes.
when you work from a volumetric point of view
mm-hmm.
that to dump toxins in that is easy to get rid of and to not be able to detect. You know, Linda Moulton Howe did a cattle mutilation study up here in Williams, Oregon,
mm-hmm.
and it made the news. And I tried to think, because mostly cattle mutilations are about doing biopsy to see if something's gotten into the water
right.
or the environment.
Right.
That's what it's all about. And then they do the disinformation, making you think it's about
a UFO and this
right.
thing. Like, what the hell's an alien eat with a cow? Come on.
Well, you know, in this case, they were actually deer that were mutilated as
mm-hmm.
well. They had actually taken down a deer and removed cornea, part of the tongue. And
Right. They always take these interesting sections.
Well, what I tried to think what would be up there in Williams that they were looking for. And it hit me that it might have been strontium-90 from Chernobyl. I think we got dusted here more than the public was told.
Hmm.
And it's simple stuff like that, you know, like Morgellons.
Right,
it's
right.
Occam's razor. Usually mm-hmm. the thing that fits most of the data is, unfortunately, the truth of it.
The truth, yeah. mm-hmm.
Well, it doesn't have to be complicated. It can be real straightforward. I think Chernobyl was a real serious
mess.
Accident.
Right.
Way, way more than the public was given. And strontium-90 got into the milk.
Hmm.
Chemtrails, same thing. I think that for every good intention, there's another road to hell. And that's what it's about, is paved to hell. You know, it's like, if someone takes advantage of the owning some property in the Ozarks and they got a bunch of caves, they're going to fill it up with garbage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're doing the same thing with individuals, not
right.
a government plot type of thing, but
right.
you know, illegal uses of well-intentioned things.
Right. And the whole shoot first and ask questions later attitude without knowing what the consequences might be.
Well, you know, the military, for example, considered that they couldn't break the law in the United States, but they can sure break it over there because they're not democratic. It's not a... You know, they're not bound by our Constitution.
And that's outrageous.
Well, it's thinking. It's the way of thinking. And that's about the new book I'm writing on how to change your belief systems so that you're, you know, able to achieve what you're seeking, and remapping the brain using brain drivers, eidetic imaging, virtual audio. There's a variety of power tools that I did studies on for the military that I'm now going to suggest could be used for the evolution of individual consciousness. Brain drivers, for example, mm-hmm. with HemiSync from Monroe Institute. Some of that stuff's very interesting.
Do you think that that's actually happening? In other words, there's this... You probably read the book, but you've read everything. But remember that book, Morning of the Magicians, Persian
I
Empire?
I do. That was a great
book. Great book, right?
That's a great book.
You know, in that one they talk about how... You know, the possibility of, you know, just walking amongst us, there are human beings that are actually sort of a different species, a superhuman that's developing.
Well, now, off the record, I have absolutely no doubt there are hybrids.
Uh-huh.
Whether they're alien or time travelers coming
right.
back to fine-tune themselves, whatever. But there are hybrids because I've actually, on government facilities, met hybrids that were way... I'm not talking about Jake 2.0. I'm talking, you know, with nanites in his body, but genetically altered and modified. And I've met them. I know that that exists because even my boss, Fleischer, was involved in the clone projects. And while I didn't involve...
Well, I'm just thinking, I mean, the stuff that's going on is just absolutely off the hook. I mean,
well, beyond your imagination. And that's imagining the unimaginable. That's a place.
When do you think it's going to break loose? In other words, I mean, things like 9/11 and all that stuff. I mean,
it is breaking loose. Edges are coming in. I think that this century, this is going to be considered the darkest century of man in terms of covert individuals and how they manipulated the masses. War is not real.
The last century, in other words, you mean?
This last century.
Yeah.
It's a war.
God, thank God you didn't mean another 100 years of it.
Yeah, what it is the Earth is overpopulated, and it's a population control thing, and they send all the breeders, the young kids. It's and medicine is another reflection of too many people on the Earth, and so, and that's someone.
Do you think that that's manufactured, though? In other words, do you think that the Earth is abundant and could manage all these people if it was done right? In other words, without?
I don't have the answers to those things. Mm-hmm. China and India have attempted population controls via other forms. I'm a nerd, and I don't have all the answers. I don't.
Right.
I can speculate, and, of course, my value systems are in just... terrible. I'm outraged at what I'm seeing.
Oh my gosh,
and there's nothing I can do personally. And I, like some of the other people now, often look both ways before I cross the street.
No doubt. But,
you know, Dr. Mack was not murdered, by the way. He was in England.
John Mack, good. I'm glad to hear
that. He looked the wrong way first. Yeah, what happened, Roger. Just like we all do.
Right.
That's probably what happened. I would say... he wasn't murdered. And I would say that, you know, he made a mistake because he was in the wrong country. Australia, when I was in Australia, it was a very difficult thing to switch gears and drive on the other side.
Yeah, I drove there, too. I know.
Yeah.
All right. Well, look, Richard, we are going to have to do this again. We could talk for hours,
I love
for sure.
It. Yeah, I enjoy your music, actually.
Well, thanks. I've got one more to finish things off. I've had sort of a downer bent with some of this stuff, but very revealing music. But this last one's a real hopeful song, and it's a real good one.
I enjoyed working with you, too.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it, and I really appreciate all the work that you've been doing. And we'll stay in touch for sure, and we'll get you back on the air here soon.
Cool.
And thanks for everything that you're doing with Nick. I know you guys get on the radio as well, so Nick Begich is doing great work, and I appreciate everything you guys are doing together. So.
Nice talking to you, Mike.
Okay, take care. And... everybody, that's it. Richard Allen Miller. You can find him on the web at Northwest Botanicals. It's nwbotanicals.org. You can link there from my site from here on out. And that's about it, all right? I'm going to boogie, and we'll play one more for you here on the way out the door. It's called Brand New Day. Ain't it the truth? Summertime's here. And stick around. We've got some good music to continue through the evening here with Crash Landing, my friend Ruth, coming up in just a minute. And like I say, one more time, this is Marcy Playground. The song is called Brand New Day. And it's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit. Have a great night, okay?
This brand new day.